Hello and welcome to The Stack. This week, our culture editor Chiara Di Mella is here talking about her latest project, The Monaco Book of Italy, which is out now. We also feature a new travel title called The Jungle Journal. Their first issue is dedicated to Latin America. And finally, a magazine dedicated to rescue dogs, Wonderdog. Wonderful. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, I speak with Gabriel Alvarez and Sara Lopez from The Jungle Journal, and Nina May, founder of Wonderdog. But first on the show, we keep things in-house. Monaco released this week The Monaco Book of Italy, a sequel to our Book of Japan released last year. Delving into all things Italy, from their cultural icons to the incredible food scene, our culture editor and Italian herself, Chiara Di Mella, edited the project with aplomb. Chiara tells me a bit more about the book.
I've been really privileged to be able to do this, and I say this because I think it's such a useful exercise for anybody to reflect about their sense of nationality and nationhood in such a profound way. You know, obviously, we all have memories of our home countries. We all have things that we love and that we sometimes, you know, can't stand that much about our own countries. But when you have to explain that over the course of over 300 pages, really delving into what is it that makes this nation special? And what is it not only that makes it special for Italians and for people like you that makes you proud about your nationality, but also what attracts other people to it? It's quite interesting to try and find the balance between those two aspects, you know, kind of using both your insight into what you know about your culture and what things mean, but also always keeping that step back distance to be able to understand also with a foreigner's eye what is so mesmerizing about this country, because so many people do love Italy.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, Italy, no matter what the news are, I mean, it can be bad, you know, economic crisis, new political leaders, but it has such a resilient soft power. I mean, like, I think almost like any other country, in a way. Why do you think is that? I mean, one of my perhaps suggestions, I mean, look, the first page in the book is summer, here comes the sun with some, you know, handsome man offering you some drinks. I mean, perhaps that's one of the, you know.
I mean, that will do it, really.
La dolce vita.
It's hard because I think a lot of the things that Italy thinks it's really good at are things that it's good at, but are not necessarily the magic ingredient that makes people fall in love with this place. And I think the cliche that most people talk about when they talk about Italy, the word that constantly comes up is passion. And I don't love that word because I think it's just too simplistic. I think when I think about what makes Italy special, I think of a sense of emotional commitment to everything. You know, I think that we just care so much about everything. And that's, you know, something that you see in the manufacturing, in the production, in the fixing of things, but also just in everyday life. You know, people care about what they look like when they go out and they get dressed. There is a sense of marrying effort with pride. And it's quite strange because even the things that feel most laid back, you know, life on the beach or that kind of thing, actually is always underscored by some level of, you know, organization. And even the chaos is what I'm trying to say does belie some weird rule and organization behind it. And I think that you can relate to it kind of maybe from a Brazilian point of view, because it's so easy to romanticize it from the outside and go like, yeah, you know, the relaxing Brazilian lifestyle, the relaxing Italian lifestyle. I think there are lots of kind of parallels between our countries there. But then actually you go to the beach in Italy and you find out that there's a very regimented way to where you should put your, you know, beach towel. And there's a very regimented way about where you should order what and when you should have your coffee and when you should have your ice cream. And it's not just a free-for-all. These are unwritten rules that everybody knows about that govern this seeming chaos. Can you relate?
Absolutely. And I could think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, even with food. I mean, I know very critical Italians. I mean, if you decide to mess up with an Italian recipe, I mean, mean, you will be told off in a way. And again, it's that thing that Italians, they care about the ingredients, the produce, you know. It's not just kind of, I think sometimes people think, oh, Italian food, just a little bit of pasta. I mean, clearly it's not that.
No, I think you make a very important point, which I think readers of our book will almost immediately notice, because the book opens with the map of Italy, but you immediately see all the regional boundaries. And something that we have really tried to honour in this book is to give you an idea of the fact that Italy is actually a very diverse country, and that the stereotype of Italy that is pizza pasta is very much a kind of almost Neapolitan-specific stereotype that's due to, obviously, migration to the US, you know, over the course of the last century. But when you actually look at Italian cuisine, it's so regionally focused. It so depends on where you are in the country. Remarkably, you know, you can have polenta in the north and like seafood in the south, and it's the same country and it's still Italian food, but it's not the Italian food that you're used to seeing on like international menus abroad. So, for example, if you go to the food section of our hospitality chapter.
Beautifully illustrated, I must add.
It's beautiful, really. This illustrator did such a fantastic job in representing all these different dishes. And I've really tried to make an effort to explain, you know, panzanella is a Tuscan salad. Farinata is a Ligurian pancake. Every single dish has a regional provenance that I think is very important for people to know and understand if they really want to understand the true heart of Italy.
And Chiara, of course, you're our culture editor. I mean, what did you bring of Italian culture? Of course, that's a very, always an exciting thing to read about, you know, Italian culture. I can see already you're in the page there with the Italian papers and Italian music as well. Because, you know, it's very easy. I think some, even people that love Italy, they like to make fun of Italian music. They perhaps because they don't know much about it. I mean, I think if you buy the book, you will find out some interesting gems there.
Of course. I mean, I don't have to teach you this because you're an expert in this. But, you know, obviously with the name Italo Disco, you already think of this kind of very camp and synth-heavy kind of 80s, 90s music production. But I think Italian music is, again, so multifaceted, and we tried to pay homage to it in this really riotous, kind of really colourful vinyl spread. I've got to thank our Rome correspondent, David Pleasant, for his impeccable taste in records, for organising this and for writing the wonderful column about Sanremo Music Festival, which I'm sure our readers will be familiar with as, I guess, the inspiration for the Eurovision Song Contest. We could go on to a huge tangent here, but we won't, because, you know, we would be talking here for ages. But I think another thing that is interesting about our approach to Italian culture in the book is that it's easy to just immediately think, you know, Italian culture, museums, you know, Roman remains. And you could fill a book just with that, just Uffizi, just, you know, the incredible wealth of classical sculptures that you can see around the country and the Roman remains and the Colosseum and all the things that people are already familiar with. But what we tried to do is to, I guess, give a monocle take on this. And so what is the contemporary art institution that we think is most interesting right now? What are the museums that you may not know about that actually give you a different perspective on the country? And also, what are the classics that if you have to see just the one, make it this? Because we're not saying that all of these things are not important. They're integral to Italian identity. It's just that through the decades and through the years, other things have emerged. You know, we've got a profile of Cinecittà, again, you know, an industry, a film industry in Italy that not so many people perhaps may know about, but something that in the mid-century of the 20th century was huge and created a huge amount of films. And then we move on to media. And I, you know, I bring this up because obviously this is a stack, and so we can really, really delve into the industry of kind of newspapers and magazines in Italy. But I think it's a very, very interesting market. And part of the reason why it's such an interesting market is because we do have this tradition of the edicola in Italian culture, which is the newsagent, which is this kiosk that you find on the street. It's not necessarily, I guess, a shop in a normal high street, but often it's a kiosk in the middle of a square. And that physical representation of somewhere where you can go and look at magazines and newspapers does have a real intense bearing on the importance that people place on printed products. What do you think?
There's been new additions recently as well. Domani, I think we've covered a little bit. And I love how Italians care about print. You know, even I spoke to the editor of the Italian Vanity Fair, which I believe comes every 15 days. So I definitely see it's still a very, very strong market.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, obviously, you know, print newspapers are being challenged in so many different ways, but I like to spotlight La Repubblica, for example, because we have covered them in the magazine before, and through the work of its creative directors, it really has rethought itself. It's redesigned a number of times in the last few years. It's showing that it cares about print, and I think there is this element of community that comes up time and time again when you talk about Italian culture in general. So, I mean, culture not in a strictly kind of chapter sense, but in a societal sense. It comes up in food, it comes up in hospitality, it comes up in the way that we use our streets and we use our cities. There's this sense of public sphere, of things being carried out in the eye of others. And that's got pros and cons, you know, because if you think about it historically, this idea that, you know, the community judges you is what is behind kind of small town mentality that many people have, you know, looked at. When you look at old Italian films with everyone spying from the windows and the nonnas sat on the chairs outside the door judging all the women that walk past, you know, that's the bad side of it. The pro side of it is that so much of Italian life does take place in the community, in the public sphere. And that encourages debate in the media as well. And that's why people show up to the Edicola and will want a paper and will want to make it an occasion to discuss with the other people who are there what is in the news, to discuss with the news agent what's on the paper that day. Everything takes place outside in this public realm. And I think that's very important to the Italian psyche.
That was Chiara Di Mella there. And remembering, the Monocle Book of Italy is out now. It's a thing of beauty. And now a beautiful new print title in the newsstands, The Jungle Journal. Created by Gabriel Alvarez and Sara Lopez, The Jungle Journal explores travel, culture, and the environment. The magazine takes us through Mexico, Brazil, Peru, and Cuba in its first issue, including an investigation of endangered languages across Latin America, and a week spent in the Brazilian coastal town of Caraíva. It can be purchased in English or Spanish. Let's find out more from Sara and Gabriel.
We met in Rio de Janeiro on Ipanema Beach. So that was where, you know, we had our first contact, and it would be interesting the days that would follow because Gabriel had a flight out the next day and I was staying, but we maintained contact and we agreed to meet up again in Mexico some months later. And that's really where the idea for this project began. We had an indefinite amount of time in the Latin world. And we would return again to Brazil, as well as going into Peru and Cuba. So that's really where this project formed, was our time over there and wanting to contribute something back and bring something back from this travel that we had. So hence the Jungle Journal was born.
And I would like to ask, perhaps, I mean, you both can tell me this. Did you guys have a background in print, or is this kind of something completely new in your lives?
For my part, really, I don't have anything. Really, this was something that was appearing, was coming up in this travel. I have a little, I was starting to learn with in photography. Then my studies are in environmentalism, environment. So that is kind of my love for the nature, culture, and the only thing that I have some knowledge, I could say. But really in the technical thing, what is printing, video, something like that, was something really new that came to me in this travel and make me learn and improve. Sara has something, she can tell, she studied something related, but...
Yeah, it wasn't exactly, my background wasn't in publishing, nor was it in the magazine world, but I do have a background in advertising. I went to portfolio school at the University of Texas at Austin, and I graduated from the Texas Creative Program there. And basically, I studied art direction, and I spent some time after in New York, interning for this small boutique agency. And that's where I got more, I guess you could say, exposure to the advertising world and working with graphic design and everything that I had under my belt with my portfolio program. But I also did a lot of photography on the side just by myself. I've always had a passion for photography. I got my first camera when I was 16, and that's just always been a passion. But everything kind of merged with this project from just my background and our own passions for the culture and environment and photography, really. So that's a little bit about my background.
No, and I could totally see kind of this attention to the environment and nature, you know, reading the Jungle Journal. And, you know, particularly the part of Brazil, I love that you guys went to places that I haven't read many pieces about, like Caraíva, you know. It's a really nice, and I guess that's your intention, to explore places that perhaps people don't know much about as well, right?
Yes, I think that's a huge part of the reason why we wanted to create this was to give more attention and voice to these places and people that don't get a whole lot of coverage, or they aren't necessarily celebrated. Even, you know, when I think about my perspective, like going into the Amazon from the Brazil part, that's something not a lot of people do. I feel like, at least in America, a lot of people go in through Peru or they go in through Ecuador, but going in and experiencing the Amazon from Brazil was really, really special and a unique experience.
Other place we were is in the La Candona jungle in Mexico. That is another place that I don't know, but I never heard before. You know, when we used to travel to Mexico, at least people from Spain, they know very well the Riviera Maya, Cancun, or Mexico City. But going to these places that really they are not very exposed to tourism is really a magic experience. You know, like to also see real places. You know, like they were not like really changed for the tourists. They conserve the unique way to be, you know. This is a part, interesting part for us, this journal.
And I would like to ask, I mean, of course, this is, you know, the first issue, and, you know, the world is kind of crazy, even to travel, it's so hard. How are you guys planning kind of, you know, to sell the magazine? Has it been a challenge, you know, to launch a title during this period? And of course, I'm sure our Stack listeners would like to know where they can find a copy as well.
It has been a challenge, I think, creating and producing and launching it during COVID, but that's also presented a lot of opportunities to get creative with how we present ourselves and show ourselves to the world. And I will say, just being very honest, since we didn't have a huge background in publishing and the print world, it's been us wearing a lot of different hats. And, you know, we switch from doing creative roles to more administrative tasks to marketing tasks. And we're learning so much. And, you know, a lot of the process has been rejection and has been receiving no's, but that's also been a great motivator to keep going and to spread even further, you know, our message and reaching out to places and just doing what we can on social media. As far as where people can purchase our magazine, we're in several different bookstores around the world. We have some here in Europe and in the US. We're in Skylight Books in Los Angeles, Casa Bosques in Mexico City. We're also at Third Place Books in Seattle, Washington. You can go ahead and go on the website to look. There's a couple of more. In Europe, there's several here in Spain as well that the bookstores were in.
And I love that you guys are already thinking, you know, I don't know how much can we review, like, about potential second editions. But one thing that is interesting, so it's not going to be just about Latin America, the title, right? So the plan is to explore, you know, our vast world.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we had an interview a couple of weeks ago when someone asked us, is it always going to be about a jungle? Is it just going to be about places that are jungle related? And it's not. It's more of kind of a representation of our world. You know, it's kind of like New York isn't a jungle. It's a concrete jungle. You know, it's a metaphorical jungle. And I feel like our world is also that. And kind of, it's a ubiquitous term to describe the different terrain that will enter in inevitably, whether that's more desert landscape or temperate or natural jungle. It's spanning all over the world, not just in the Latin world. So
that was Sara Lopez and Gabriel Alvarez from the Jungle Journal. The first issue is out now. And now, a magazine that is difficult not to fall in love with, Wanderdog. The title aims to tell the stories of rescue dogs and their people. The biennial title was founded by Nina May. Here is Nina with more on the delightful title.
So, Wanderdog is focused on rescue dogs. The wordplay is, the magazine is for underdogs and wanderdogs. So, it's the rescue dogs that, you know, got out. And I think, in essence, obviously, a rescue dog magazine is a very small category, isn't it? But in essence, every rescue dog embodies a story of hope. And this story of hope resonates with so many people, whether they're dog lovers or cat lovers even, or whether, you know, they don't have any connection with the animal world, but they feel strongly about getting involved in things, you know, helping to protect the environment, helping animals. All those people, I think, find something in Wanderdog as well. So it's a very engaged magazine where we have a lot of tips on how to get engaged in charities, how to help out and stuff. So in that sense, it's actually quite a two-way street almost, the magazine. So I get a lot of people emailing in and sort of telling me what they've done, for example.
No, and you mentioned the word hope there. That's something that we all needed in 2020. It's been such a difficult year for many. But the magazine has a very positive tone to it, which I love. And it starts on your editor's letter. I mean, in fact, you were saying that even for the dog rescue charities, actually, they've done well as well during lockdown. You know, they really worked hard about it. I love that optimistic tone.
Yes, I think it's so important to stay optimistic, because the magazine is, you know, it's highly produced. It's printed on very luxurious paper. It's the same paper stock that you find at Frankie magazine. Actually, I love Frankie. So the taking the same paper stock was an homage to Frankie. But, you know, it's meant to be a magazine that you should keep on your table. It's a coffee table magazine. And I just don't think that you want to keep something on your table that is negative. I don't want to, you know, show any dogs in distress, and I don't want to have anything that, you know, that is gut-wrenching. I don't believe that you will keep that around.
And I love, you know, I love dogs. I mean, who doesn't almost? I love that you make dogs characters in a way. There's this brilliant photo story with Belinha, which is actually a dog from Brazil, but she's in London now. I thought it was super fun, and I could connect in one way or another, being Brazilian.
Thank you. Yeah, Belinha is a superstar. I mean, with those ears, she is an extraordinary dog, and everybody knows her because she is the daughter, I nearly said, the rescue dog of the blogger who runs the Dog Vine, Teresa Kehoe. And Belinha just... she knows how to model. She's so much fun to see in action. So she was the perfect dog for the story in London.
And what's your personal experience with rescue dogs, Nina?
Well, I grew up with, I think, non-rescue dog. I think back in the 70s, they were just called dogs. You know, I'm not sure if we really had that distinction. So I grew up with a Dachshund, and I always knew that I wanted to have a dog again. And when I went freelance in 2005, it was pretty clear that as a freelancer, I could have a dog again. So I became what we call a foster failure. I just wanted to foster. And of course, I fell in love with the dog. And of course, I kept the dog forever. And that was my dog Pippa that inspired Wanderdog. And I became really involved in and fascinated by the people in rescue and by the incredible sense of community. I mean, you know, you buy a dog, your story is, I bought a dog, just like you buy a handbag in Harrods. But if you have a rescue dog, oh my God, you know, you connect in the park. My dog had a similar fate to yours, and my dog was found abandoned in the street, and, you know, I had to teach her how to eat and stuff. There are so many stories that connect you, and that rescue people and rescue dog world, I thought really, you know, cried out for a magazine.
No, they did, and some people might say, you know, oh my God, this is so niche. I mean, but there's so much actually, you know. And even in your magazine, there's a nice the travel section. I thought it was quite nice as well, kind of dog friendly places to go as well. And I mean, to be honest, this can be useful even if it's for a non rescue dog as well.
Yeah, especially the story from East Crete that we had, which was written by a very good travel writer, Heidi Fuller Love, who writes a lot for The Telegraph. And the idea there was, we didn't so much put it in because laws can change, but the idea is definitely that you can, you know, borrow a rescue dog from the charity, from Tarkus Shelter that we featured, and explore, you know, East Crete for the day with a dog. So even if you don't have your own dog, I think if you wanted to, you know, strike a relationship with a local shelter and take a dog out for the day, why not?
No, absolutely. What about the business side of Wonder Dog? I was wondering, because of course you're German, but you're based here in the UK, and the magazine has quite an international tone to it. You know, a lot of countries are mm-hmm. featured, a lot of different organizations, you know, from Thailand, you know, to the UK itself. Is that your intention, to have kind of an international readership?
Yeah, I think Wonder Dog is unashamedly international because the rescue dog community is largely international. And there's a lot of best practice that we can learn from each other. I think at the moment, anybody interested in animal welfare should look to Greece, for example. They've done a quantum leap when it comes to dog welfare. And we can learn from one another. And of course, you know, in the UK, there are often these, what I call puppy Brexiters, who don't want to have dogs in from other countries. But by and large, the rescue dog community is international. You've got volunteers, you know, for example, if you want to go to Brazil, you know, you can find a charity where you can, instead of just traveling the country, spend a few weeks volunteering in a shelter. Those kind of holidays or trips are, I think, quite common now. Now, when it comes to the business side, that, of course, is different because I'm theoretically targeting the whole world. Practically, it's 2/3 UK, 1/3 US readers at the moment. There are a few in Germany, Canada is doing quite well, Thailand is doing well. But yeah, it is a very broad spectrum. I admit that.
That was Nina May from Wonder Dog. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fpandmonaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. Meanwhile, you can always listen to the show again and subscribe on monaco.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. But before we go, a little song for you. It combines two things I like in life, dogs and disco. This is Wonder Dog with Rough Mix. The song peaked at number 31 in the UK charts back in 1982. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.